Watchman's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Ryan, and I am an alcoholic.
I'm Ryan.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God?
Grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. They are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing step 12. Please welcome our panel. We have Mike and Guyanne. All right, so step 12 states, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I will read the first paragraph on page 89, and then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. So, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to the other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives.
Want to start us out, Mike?
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Does this work? Yeah. As soon as I finished working the steps, and I didn't go through the steps fast. My sponsor tried to pull me through the steps, and I basically fought with him on every one of the steps. And in fact, I even waited about 3 months before I even started the steps. It wasn't until I really was miserable that I started working the steps. I got a sponsor and started working the steps. As soon as I got through, I thought, well, now it's time for a break. And my sponsor said, no, you have to be working with others right away. And it was like, who's going to want me to sponsor them? He goes, well, you can start working with others before you sponsor them. Just talking to newcomers. And at first, that's what I was doing. I was talking to newcomers. And it was probably, I probably had a year and a half, almost 2 years in, before the first person asked me to be their sponsor. And I knew I was clueless. I didn't have an idea what I was doing. So what I did then is what I do now, and that is I brought it to my sponsor, and he guided me along all the way. I don't think I would be sober today if it wasn't for the fact that I was sponsored people almost continuously for the whole time I've been sober.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, family. I'm Guyan, a grateful recovering alcoholic. And carrying the message to others has been really beneficial in my life. My sobriety date is June 25th, 1987. And my sponsor had me to first write my story and then explain it to him. And back in the day, there weren't a lot of lady sponsors in that little area. I'm from DC. And so I learned to write about my feelings early on in this program. And by writing about it, I could talk about it. And I was shy. I was a teacher at one point in my life, and dance and physical education. So I could get up in front and do all this stuff. But if I had to talk to AA people, I would go like a little bird and you know. And my sponsor said, "What is wrong with you?" I said, "Well, I don't know what to say. Talk about yourself. Be honest. The purpose is to help others with what you've gone through." I said, "Well, I've been through a lot." And that's the whole point, that this 12 step is trying to prepare us to be of service to others, to be able to understand where we came from. And my first drink was at 10 years old. And I was afraid of everybody and everything. And by coming into AA, I was able to get some courage and confidence, and I was able to build relationships with the people that I talked to. And they had me stand out at the door and greet people. I said, "But I don't know these people." That's the point. You got to learn people and everything, because I was a good alcoholic. I would drink and hide out, And learning to trust folks. I'm a product of a spousal abuse, so I had to learn to trust, and that was real rough. And that's the whole thing of being able to share my story with somebody. And with the ladies that I share my stories with, I realized all the crap that I went through, every one of my sponsees has part of my story. I'm like, oh, that's what it is. So all of the crap you go through, raise a flag, because it's going to help somebody. You may not think it's going to help anybody right now, but it will in the future. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, now we're going to turn over to page 91. See your man alone if possible. At first, engage in general conversation. After a while, turn the talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him to speak of himself. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. You will thus get a better idea of how you ought to proceed. If he is not communicative, give him a sketch of your drinking career up to the time you quit, but say nothing for the moment of how that was accomplished. If he's in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor has caused you, being careful not to moralize or lecture. If his mood is light, tell him humorous stories of your escapades. Get him to tell some of his.
I love that part, because the best I am at helping people is when I can relate to them and they relate to me. And when I speak at a speaker's meeting, I was young when I got sober, and I always try to pick out, you know, some guy in his mid-20s who's in there court by the courts, who's had a bunch of drunk driving charges and everything else, who doesn't want to be there and is angry. And I pick out one person like that, and I talk to them, because they're the people that I relate to. I try to help any alcoholic who needs help, but the ones who I relate to, the ones who had the same background as I do, I can share my story and they'll understand it. They'll realize that they're not alone in their anger and frustration at how miserable everything is going in their life when they hear what my story was. And you know, a lot of times, a lot of people I met have got the exact same stories as mine. You know, in and out. I was in and out of AA from, I didn't get sober till I was 27, but from 18 to 27, I was almost continuously sent to AA for one arrest or another, constantly being sent. and did not want to be there at all. And so when I see somebody who doesn't want to be there, I automatically can relate to them because I was there at one time. And just sharing with them is so important because I can't really help someone unless I can relate to them and they can relate to me.
All right. The first part, it says, see your man alone. I found that when I'm working with sponsees, it's real important for me to take them off somewhere, because in one of my experiences, I had a fellow AA that has a little bit of time. Every time I was talking to my girls, he thought that he should have something to say to her. And I tried to be nice about it, and I tried to be polite, and I realized that I'm gonna have to find another venue, because it was after the meeting and everybody wanted to have 2 cents in my dime, and I'm like, it's not gonna work, not happening. And I realized that if I can laugh at me telling my story, then that makes my sponsees feel a little bit more comfortable. And the other thing is, if you're in a crowded room, it's a lot of distractions. You know, as a good alcoholic, you know, squirrel, squirrel, you know, everything distracts us and everything. And so I had to learn how not to talk too much and to be able to listen. And I would shoot a few things at my sponsees, you know. Yeah, I was sitting in my daughter's baby chair, drinking my beer and crying, and she came up and put my head on her shoulder and said, Mommy, I'll take care of you. And I'm like, you can't take care of me. And I went through a whole thing, and then she had to bring me tissues and everything. And that was, I call her my angel, because she's the one that brought me into AA. That was a wake-up call for me. Another incident is that I was at my mother's funeral, and a good Southern Baptist doesn't discuss their alcoholic background. And so my son thought it was his place to say, we're going over auntie's, aren't you coming? I said, no, because I know they were going to be drinking and drugging there. And then he says out loud, well, Ma, I don't even believe you're an alcoholic. I've never seen you drink. And I'm like, okay. So I kept it real low key and everything. The point is, I don't have to discuss my sobriety with my family members. I have to discuss my sobriety with people that understand me. That's other alcoholics. And the thing that helps me more so than anything is that I pray before I talk to folks. And my English seems to not work on real people. But when I pray, then I'm being like a channel, because my sister's still out there doing her thing. And when I tried to talk to her about AA, it didn't work. And now that I've been praying for her, she's calling and asking me questions about AA, and I'm like, yes! And so God's working. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, continuing on page 91. When he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. Give him an account of the struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. We suggest you do this as we have done it in the chapter on alcoholism. If he is alcoholic, he will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. If you are satisfied that he is a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower. Don't at this stage refer to this book, unless he has seen it and wishes to discuss it. And be careful not to brand him as an alcoholic. Let him draw his own conclusion. If he sticks to the idea that he can still control his drinking, tell him that possibly he can, if he is not too alcoholic. But insist that if he is severely afflicted, there may be little chance he can recover by himself.
I found that when I'm sharing, is usually when you're working with someone new, they'll start telling you all their, showing that they have power over alcohol, they'll show you all the ways they can control it. And then I'd share my stories with them. And I went through the same thing everybody else did. There was one time, like in 1982, I had an alcohol-related arrest. Actually, no, it was 1981. I had a drunk driving charge, and I had to go to the drunk driving school. And they gave me something that was going to guarantee I would never get another drunk driving charge again. Way to finally control my drinking. It was a blood alcohol calculator. And you, there's a little slide rule, and you put in your how much you drank and what your weight is, and to give your blood alcohol level. And as long as you were under 0.1, you were legal and safe. I would never get another drunk driving charge again. I was convinced of that. It would never happen. And years after I got sober, I found that blood alcohol calculator, and it was all mangled and twisted. And it dawned on me, what I used to do when I get drunk is I would put in my weight and the number of drinks, and I'd twist it till I could get it under 0.1. And I remember sharing that with new guys, and they would relate to that. You know, it's like anything you can do to possibly control it, you know. And for me, that point, everybody's got a different point where they go over the line. The arrests really weren't a big deal to me. You know, it was, to me, it was just a hazard of the sport, more or less. It wasn't really, I didn't like getting arrested, of course not, but it wasn't enough to make them, especially back then, because the states weren't linked together by computer. So after you max out drunk driving charges in one state, you just move to another state and get a license there. So. But the thing that got me, and this is the point where, you know, if guys relate to this, it helps out a lot, and that was, in the beginning, you know, alcohol was this wonderful elixir that turned me into somebody that I always wanted to be, an outgoing person. I was introverted, and I became this outgoing person. Alcohol did that for me, and I swore that I was never going to be like my father died of cirrhosis of the liver when he was 48. And I swore I would never be like that. And at the end of my drinking, I was sitting there in a t-shirt with a bottle at my kitchen table in my rundown apartment, just drinking liquor by myself. And I had become like my old man. And I was a heck of a lot younger than him, too. And when he died, anyways, I was a lot younger. And to me, that was my bottle. And, you know, on one hand, I can't tell another person that they're an alcoholic, but I can share my story of when I was at my bottom, when I didn't want to feel any worse than I felt, when that was the point where it was time for a change. And if the person discovers it's time for their change, they'll let you know.
Okay. It says, describe yourself as an alcoholic. I had to come into AA to find out that I was a functional alcoholic. Being a teacher and mother, I would drink after taking care of my responsibilities, being a good mother. And I had to learn what a functional alcoholic was. I could stay stopped. I could stop, but I couldn't stay stopped. I could stop if we were performing and I had rehearsals, and I needed to be real clear about what I had to do, stage directions and all that kind of stuff. And to celebrate after the show, we would get a little intoxicated. And I would have the pretty drinks where you had your pinky up. And my friends didn't like the way I drank, and so they would complain about me because I would throw the pink ladies back, or I throw the daiquiris back, and rum was my world. I loved rum. Rum and everybody, and anybody, excuse me. The point is, I realized that I was a real alcoholic because I can, to this day, remember my first drink. I was 10, mother was having a card party, I was cleaning up the ladies' cups, and I would take all their cups and pour it into mama's cup. And I was in the kitchen and they were in the front room. And that feeling, that just warm, tingly, and I was like, woo! And I was out there dancing and picking up the trays and entertaining them and everything. Oh, isn't she cute, was the response. And my mother said, girl. And you know, that told, that let me know that I was always chasing that same feeling, because that made me an alcoholic. Is that if I had one, then I had to have another and another and another. And I used to get the, I think it's called Foster's. It looks like an oil can. Oh, yes. It was just so big. And you could drink it and drink it and drink it. And I didn't have to keep getting the little cans. But, I mean, I would go into the liquor store and take my glasses and read, let's see, 100 proof, 90 proof. And I would go through there and realizing that normal people don't do that. And that's what my spot. Normal people don't do that, dear. I'm like, oh, okay. It's all right. And I realized that I would put the kids in the bed, I worked, take care of the house, do all the stuff for the children, put them in the bed, and then I would go, because my stash at that time was in the trunk of the car. And I would go to the trunk of the car, the kids asleep, I'm in the car drinking and crying. Like I said, I was a victim of spousal abuse, and I survived that, but I felt bad, and so I had to cry in my beer or whatever, and to be able to deal with the hopelessness, I didn't realize what insanity was. Because I kept drinking, thinking it was going to get better, just a little bit better. It had to get a little bit better. And every time it ended up with me upchucking and diarrhea and all those other things happening, and I had a sensitive stomach. If you drink like a fish, my God, what do you want? And I had to also learn what, I thought I had willpower. Being a dancer, I could drink, go to the parties, you know, and I'd get up and I'd be heels this high, and I would always break the heel on the right shoe, bam, you know, doing. And realizing that I had to close the party down, I had to have the last drink and look around and see who left something on the table. Normal people don't do that. And I was told, I was helped to understand that I was special. And so I had to learn to deal with my speciality by coming in here and being able to look at that. Is that if you're crazy, you're crazy. I mean, hello. So what do we do for crazy folks? We pray for them. We teach them not to be crazy. And we let them know that you're not alone, you're just as crazy as I am, what up? You know, don't feel like you're special, because you're not. We all, this disease is no respecter of anything or anybody, and we all suffer from the same situation. Get alcohol in us, and we go crazy. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, continuing on page 91. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. Doctors are rightly loath to tell alcoholic patients the whole story unless it will serve some good purpose. But you may talk to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism because you offer a solution. You will soon have your friend admitting he has many, if not all, the traits of the alcoholic. If his own doctor is willing to tell him that he's an alcoholic, so much the better. Even though your protege may not have entirely admitted his condition, he has become very curious to know how you got well. Let him ask you that question, if he will. Tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. When dealing with such a person, you had better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There is no use arousing any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. Don't raise such issues, no matter what your own convictions are.
On the hopelessness part of it, what I always try to explain to someone new is on my story, I went downhill fast, as most people can realize, really, really fast. And as I said before, when I came in, you know, that magical elixir had opened up this door, this window of sociability. And at the end of my drinking, that window was shut completely. I had two states. I had nervous wreck and falling down drunk. And, you know, there was no window of sociability left at all. You know, I you know, was either so nervous I wanted to jump out of my skin, or I was sloppy and falling down. And that was the point where I realized, and I think a lot of people, I actually feel sorry for people that have long drinking careers, because it's kind of like the frog that they put in water and turn the temperature up. You know, they pass through the fun, and they don't even know when they're out of the fun. You know, they think they're still having fun. And the absence of excruciating pain for a little bit of time isn't usually fun. It's just, you know, it's just getting through. And I see that happen to a lot of people. And, you know, I'll hear them describing their life, and I'm thinking to myself, you really think you're having fun? You know, and I won't say that to them, but when I can share with them how hopelessness it was for me, the point where, because I went downhill really fast, I could see that that wasn't really fun anymore. You know, the being miserable from the point I woke up until I got that alcohol in me and I got the relief, and then I was basically drunk shortly thereafter, made my whole day pretty much miserable. Even when I started drinking, it was just relief. You know, it wasn't the magical elixir anymore. It was the escape of pain, and that's all it was. And when I share that, a lot of times they can relate to that. And the spiritual part of it, because when I got sober, I was going to, is the predecessor of IKIPA, Young People's Meetings. IKIPA formed in the summer of 86, and before that, it was just, it went through all these different acronyms. It was one right after another, and then in 86, they settled on IKIPA. And I was going to all these young people meetings, and I really, when I started sponsoring people, really spoon-fed the very small amounts of the spirituality part to it, because I noticed for young people, it would turn them off quickly. Either that, or they'd either be like yes men and, you know, say, oh yeah, I'm being all spirit, or else they would just turn the other way. And so it's one of those things where, as you get into the steps, it's a spiritual program. And to even in any way kind of force any kind of spirituality, even non-religious spirituality, on somebody can turn a lot of people off. Although they used to always say, if God, you know, scares you out of the rooms, you know, alcoholism will scare you back in. And that's true. But I know for me, it was spoon-fed to me. And it was one of the reasons that allowed me to accept it, because I had real God issues when I got in here. And if they're miserable enough to work the steps, and they really get into the steps, there will come a point where their mind will open up to the spirituality.
Thank you. Alcoholism as an illness, I didn't realize. I'm at the bars drinking, and all of a sudden my ears close up, so I can't hear what's going on, so I get go into a falsetto. What did you say? And I'm at the bar for more than 1 hour. That got real old quick. And people would give me drinks just so I didn't have to talk. And I am allergic to hops in beer. I got a lot of allergies, and I'm asthmatic. And the only time that I would smoke is when I was drinking. Asthmatic, come on. I can't breathe, but I was cool. And that's the whole thing. I drank because I wanted to be cool. I didn't feel a part of things, and so if I could look a certain way, then I could fit in. And that's what I share with my ladies. And when I came in, sponsees were called pigeons. And I didn't like that term, because I thought pigeons meant people dumping on you, you know, like they do on the buildings. And I had a elder statesman tell me that a pigeon back in the 30s carries the message from here to there. So I had to learn that. I said, well, I still don't like the word pigeon, so I call them my bunnies, my angels, my ladies, because I felt really bad. When I would drink, I was trying to cover up my feelings and feeling like less than. That's why I talk to my ladies like they're ladies. When I first came in, folks were not talking to the females with a lot of respect. And they called me some things that folks didn't even call me in the street. And I said, well, I'm not gonna be able to deal with that. And I had to get a tough skin, I guess is what they call it, is that don't take stuff personally. Everybody has an opinion, like a bottom, you know. But you don't need to share theirs, and they don't need to share yours. And so I had to learn that piece too, is that I had to learn, for the first 10 years, I was AA 100%, and then I got bored. That's a word I don't use ever. And I stopped going to meetings. I got into a relationship. I fell in dumb. I didn't say fall in love, but I fell in dumb because I put all the emphasis on the other person. Do you have to go to those meetings? No, I know what they're gonna say, I know it. My ego was all that and a bag of chips, and I thought I knew some stuff. But what I did, being a dancer, I took the slogans, and I would make up dance routines to the slogans, like easy does it, easy does it, let go, let God, and we go across the dance floor with the AA slogans. And that's how I got my second sponsor. She happened to be one of my students, and they used to call me Mama Guy. And I would do spiritual readings. I was all knowing and all ethereal. And so she let everybody leave the studio. She says, are you a friend of Bill's? I said, oh, how did y'all find me? And everything. And she helped me because she became my friend. I was her teacher, but she became my friend, and she says, you have to come in here. You don't have to be by yourself anymore. This is a we program. And so she took me to some meetings, and I cried the whole time I was at the meetings, and I prayed to be able to put the ego down and be able to compare myself in. And I asked, I said, well, why didn't I didn't even have a desire to pick up a drink or a drug for 5 years. And the thing is, she said, you were on a spiritual tip. Well, I was raised a Baptist, and then I became a Buddhist, and I became a Kemetan, and then I dabbled in a whole lot of different religions. And I didn't fit in, and I had to come back here to AA to find out that I had to develop a relationship with the God of my understanding. And I was told that if you get these principles under your belt, you'd be good. And so at the time, my brain wasn't really functioning as well. And so I could deal with one word principles. For the 12 steps, each step had a principle. One was honesty, two was hope, three was faith, four was courage, five was truthfulness or integrity, as they say. Six was willingness. Seven was humility or meekness, because I didn't realize thinking so much of myself is not really the deal. I'm supposed to be selfless, not so me, me, me. It's all about me. Brotherly love or being kind and compassionate, discipline, 9, 10 was perseverance, or being persistent, continuing to do something over and over again. It becomes a way of life. And 11 was spirituality, being aware that there is energy in the room. There's a spirit in the room. Every AA meeting I've gone to, I could feel God in there because he's always here with us, trying to help us. And 12 was being of service. And 12 is also, I was taught, love. When you talk to somebody else, you sharing yourself, a part of me, with a part of you. And we have that exchange. And what I try to do is be friends with my sponsees, because I know how it felt coming in. I didn't think I deserved to be all the things that AA teaches us to be. And by being a friend, and that's what I tell them, I said, you're helping me to help you to help me. And that's the key, is that even if it doesn't work for somebody else, it worked for me because I didn't drink. And the being able to speak everyday English and not go through the academics, prove that I have more than one degree, prove that I've worked here, there, and everywhere. I don't have to do that in here. All I have to do is be basic, bring it down to brass tacks, keep it simple, and not get on a high horse and realize that I'm equal to you and you're equal to me. The difference is a little bit of time, but we all have the same disease. And that means that we're all gonna respond to stuff similarly. And the God of our understanding works with us individually. Your God and my God may not be the same. When I first came in, they told us to get the radiator, you know, if that could be your higher power. And I said, well, that doesn't make any sense. You know, the radiator, some people said it was the doorknob. Anything but me being my own God. And that's the whole concept. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, now we're going to move over to page 94. Outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out your past, and why you are now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. Make it plain he is under no obligation to you, that you hope only that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. Suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. Make it clear that he is not under pressure, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call off, for he has helped you more than you have helped him. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you have perhaps made a friend. Maybe you have disturbed him about the question of alcoholism. This is all to the good. The more hopeless he feels, the better. He will be more likely to follow your suggestions.
One of the things I usually try to do is, as soon as I meet a newcomer and I give them my phone number, you know they're hesitant to call. You know they don't want to put you out, and you know they. And one of the things I always quickly explain to them is that you're doing me more good than you're doing yourself. You know, you may or may not stay sober, but what you're giving the person who you call, no matter how long they've been sober, is a piece of sobriety that they can't get anywhere else. They can go to meetings and they can work the steps, they can pray, and they get other pieces. But the piece that you get from having a newcomer call you, especially someone really desperate, where you have to remember what it felt like, you can only get from them. And I try to explain that to them. Then when they call you, they don't feel like they're imposing, and it helps out a lot. The one part is said here about outline the program of action. I'm always wondering how much detail do I go into, because too much detail in the beginning can be not a good thing. And I usually try to explain to them roughly in the fourth through seventh step that what we're actually doing this, we're discovering these things that make us absolutely miserable. See, by my first time through the steps, I thought they want to take away what little fun I have left in my life, you know, my character defects. They're all the source of all my fun. And my sponsor was able to explain it to me over a long period of time that every one of my character defects causes me much more pain than any sick little pleasure that I pull from it. And when I finally got that, that's when I could actually go from hating the steps but needing to get through them to actually embracing the steps and loving the steps. And but you can't really explain that to a newcomer. They don't really get that. So it's one of those things, once again, that I found that I have to kind of spoon feed to them. That because even if they could see the picture of what they're going to become, from the sick mind that I had when I was new, I'm not sure if I would want that, you know, because they say it gets greater than your wildest dreams. Well, my wildest dreams are just plain insane dreams is what they were. And so the final package is a wonderful package now that I have it. But if I looked at it from the standpoint of 26-year-old active alcoholic, it didn't look all that great. So I'm usually very careful about spoon feeding that. One thing, I haven't drifted away from AA. I've been in it, I've been probably going averaging 4 or 5 meetings for the entire time I've been in here. I've never gone a week without meetings. But one big part about that too is in the spring of 87, I met a young woman in AA, and we've been happily married for 28 years, and we raised 4 kids. And the result of that, we both of us sponsor people, and it just is the thing. We sponsor people, we go to meetings, it's been a part of our life. You know, AA is more than just for me going to meetings. I play bass in several bands, most of them are AA bands. You know, I play golf with guys in AA, I go scuba diving with guys in AA. I've got other people from work and stuff like that, but to tell you the truth, they're pretty boring. The AA people are they're the fun people. You know, I like being around alcoholics. I really do. And it's the focus of my life. It has been, you know, since I got sober.
Okie doke. Program of action. I was told don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor. Develop a relationship with the God of your understanding, and get a network, get telephone numbers. I was told to get 3 numbers every meeting. They said you go to 90 meetings in 90 days, so I had to get 3 telephone numbers each meeting I went to. So I had a whole lot of numbers. But like you said, calling was another thing, and I realized that I was afraid to call because I didn't know what to say. And then I was told, you don't have to say anything except for your name. Hi, this is Guyanne. Oh yeah, I remember you, da da da. And the person will go on and on and on. And you may be able to throw something in there every now and then. But that's how AAers do it, is that we know each other. We know we're shy, we know we don't want to reach out and ask for help. And that's another thing that I had to be taught, is that by making a phone call, I was not only helping myself, I was helping the person that I was calling. And that helped me get to doing telephone calls easier. The other thing is that if you want this, you want what we have, you have to do what we did. And that meant going to meetings, all types of meetings. I used to like to go to the candlelight meetings because, you know, it was a dark room. And I would, I used to have shoulder-length hair, and I would put on wigs and hats and go to those meetings so that I could hide out in the meeting, because I thought anonymity meant that you didn't know who I was in the meeting. And so at that point, my sponsor had me get a dictionary. Now, I've even been to college, and I have a degree to teach. Ha! Huh. And I just didn't know my vocabulary words for AA, and I had to learn them. And I had to also realize that the phone therapy is the most important thing. The experience that I had, I told you I was not in meetings for 5 years. For 5 years, I had to take care of my mom. She had 8 strokes and 2 heart attacks. And I couldn't go to meetings near the end of her life. And I would run into a meeting and run out, running in and out. And by not being able to go to meetings, I had to use the telephone. I had a sponsor in D.C., I had a sponsor here, I had a spiritual advisor here. So I had three main people that I would have to call on a regular basis because sometimes I couldn't get out. She needed me more than me needing to go to the meetings. And being able to realize that when I started to sponsor people, not to hold them with the vice grip, you're mine, and that's not the way it's supposed to be. And I've seen some sponsors like that. You have to do it their way. If you don't, then they're this, that, and the other. And a lot of people have come and asked me to sponsor them. Well, she said she wouldn't work with me because of this and because of that. And I said, oh, okay, everybody does it differently. And I had to realize I couldn't take anything personally. When I work with somebody for X number of whatever, and they decide they want to do something else. I don't want to go to AA anymore. I'm not really an alcoholic. I don't think I was an alcoholic anyway. I said, oh, okay. I said, well, call me when you decide you want to do this thing. And, just call me. I'm still a friend, you know. Just because I'm an AA doesn't make me a plague, you know. I'm not going to force it down your throat. I'm still a friend. And I had to learn to show gratitude, especially when people who walk through the doors of AA, to remember everybody that walks through sick just like me, and that I cannot have expectations. If I'm your sponsor, then you have to do this. If I'm your sponsor, you have to do that. No. A sponsor is supposed to guide you through the steps. When your butt's on fire, they usually pick up the phone and call you, and you're supposed to try to talk them out the trees, talk them away from the drink, talk them away from the bars. The idea is that the telephone was my friend. It used to not be, but it is today. And I realized that that's a process. And that's the other thing that this program of action has taught me, is that my process is different than yours. And I have to honor that and respect that. And when I came in here a jackrabbit. I read all 12 steps in one meeting. Boom, I was done. And I read the book from cover to cover, went to a big book study, and said, well, when did they put the doctor's opinion? Is that new? They said, keep coming back. Because my mind was not there. I could give the illusion of being, you know, all here, but my mind was not clear for a long time. And so I'm a turtle. I have a turtle bracelet, turtle necklace, and now that I have this thing, I really am a turtle. And I realize slow and steady is how I'm learning to stay sober. You don't run through this thing to stay sober. You have to take it at your pace. And that's what this whole thing, this program of action, your action is what's important, not mine. Thanks.
Thank you. And then we're going to move over to page 96 for the final paragraph. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects. He often said that if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance.
When I picked my first sponsor, the way I picked them was I didn't really want to do anything. I just wanted the results. And so I picked the most easygoing guy that I could find who I didn't think would have me do anything. And back then, where I got sober, they usually pick your sponsor for you. And he got together with his friends and his sponsor, and they decided, Mike is a real hardhead. He's been in and out. We've seen him coming in for slip signing for years. You know, it's not going to work with you. And they gave me this old retired Marine drill sergeant. I couldn't stand the guy. And at first I acted like a kid with his hand caught in a cookie jar. Like, you know, how could you, but I realized it was the best thing for me. I needed that. And we can't work with all people, you know, and there's different meshing. And I really still believe in the whole idea of having, you know, the worst person for picking a sponsor is a newcomer. They don't know what they need. And the best is for other people to get together and as a group to think about the person and what that person, who would mesh well with that person. And I really still believe that that's the best way for it. Whether I'm going to sponsor someone or not doesn't mean that I wouldn't be friends with them if I'm not sponsoring them. And so a lot of times I'll start sponsoring someone and someone else, either they'll discover somebody else as a sponsor or I'll, you know, realize that somebody else is better and we'll discuss it and they may change sponsors and I try to remain friends with them. The all the different activities that the bands that I play in and, you know, the groups that I dive with, the group that I play golf with has got like 25 guys in it, all in AA. A lot of the people are coming in, you know, they're new, they start playing with us and whatever, and then they start drinking again, and then they're afraid to be around us, and we're saying, it's okay, you know, it's okay, don't show up drunk for band practice, and don't show up drunk when we're playing golf, but, you know, if you're not in AA, that's fine, you're still friends with us, you know, and sometimes they drift away, sometimes they stay around us, and they slowly come in, or maybe they stumble a few times, and they come in. You know, they're the same as me. They're alcoholics, you know, and at various stages in their life and in their misery and in their recovery. And I try to just be there for them is what I try to do. And there have been very, very few real toxic situations where, and now I've been sober long enough so I can tell when one is, when all of a sudden the person is like, you know, almost like trying to lure me back into a drink, and then I do have to kind of put up some distance. But you know, for me, the first and foremost is I try to be a friend to the people in AA, and I'm not the best sponsor for everyone, you know. And there's a right sponsor for everyone, and it's not necessarily me. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Learning to not take things personally. If I spent time with somebody and they go back out, I don't take that personally. My first sponsee, bless her, she was dual addicted and she died of an overdose. And I thought it was all my fault. And I went through a whole big thing about that. And my sponsor said, well, did you put the drugs into her system? I said, no. Did you give her the drink? I said, no. He said, well, it's not your responsibility. You were there to help her, but you didn't make the decision for her to go back out. And I had to learn that was a real thin line, because when you talk to somebody and you invest time, you think that you owe, or they owe you, or you owe them. We are here on this journey together. And some people are supposed to stay the course, some people fall off. And the whole point about the program is to be able to pray, to be able to work with the people that you're supposed to work with whenever. I always do my best when I work with my ladies. And I'm also a spiritual advisor for some of the young men. And I realize that I have to be honest no matter who I work with. I have to practice detachment, acceptance, forgiveness, and love with all the folks that I interact with in AA, sponsees or not. Angels or not, bunnies or not, advisees or not. We all are human beings, and we all deserve to get the best out of this scenario. And some people want it, and some people don't. And I was also told that everybody's bottom is going to be different. You may think that this was their bottom, and it's not. God's got the plan for all of us, and he does not send out tweets, memos, or texts to let us know what they are. So when the time comes that somebody leaves you, or in any way that they leave you, whether they choose another sponsor, whether they choose to get out of the program, whether they choose to do it their own way. Because it's, AA says it's, there are a lot of different ways to become sober. We don't have a monopoly on that. And so I can't hold this thing. It says you have to wear it like a loose garment, very, so that I don't go crazy. Because not that I'm possessive or anything, but you're all mine. and that's kind of how I say we're a family. And that's why I always greet, hello family, because you guys became my family. My real blood family, or most of them are still out there drinking and drugging, or they're dead. So you guys are my new family. Thank you.
All right, thank you both for sharing with us this evening. I will now pass the seventh tradition basket. And the seventh tradition states, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's and rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. And do we have any AA-related announcements?
My name is Ashton. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
Virginia State Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous, also known as VISCPA, one of the many PAs, is having a dodgeball tournament on August 11th at the Church of the Nazarene in Virginia Beach from 12 to 4. It is a $5 suggested donation. So if you are interested, I have flyers, so please see me after. And also, the convention, the VISCPA convention 2018, will be held here in Virginia Beach. On October 26th weekend at the Holiday Inn, and you definitely don't want to miss that. So see me after for more info. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing. All right,
gentlemen,
Cornerstone Group, right next door to here, is having their 6th anniversary on August the 4th. We're having a potluck. Bring a dish if you wish. It starts at 5:30. The speaker will be at 7 o'clock. It's a lady from your town. But we're having a Hawaiian luau is our theme for our anniversary, and like I said, it's August 4th, 5:30 dinner and fellowship, and 7 o'clock is the speaker.
Thanks.
Anybody else? All right, 2 days later, actually, on Monday, August 6th, the Simple Actions Group is having our supper and a speaker. Potluck starts at 6 and 7 p.m. We will have Paul McHugh all the way from Rockaway Beach, New York. Please come out and join us.
Thank you.
Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hand, please. And do we have anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety so that we can welcome you?
Hey. Welcome.
I'm Brett.
Hey, Brett. Welcome. There's one over there.
Oh.
Hey, Scott. Welcome.
Is anybody else? No? We do have literature available on the table to your left. Pamphlets are for free. The books are for sale at cost. Just see a hungry member after the meeting if you'd like one. And sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come up and talk. As a reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. And in closing, I'd like to thank the panel for sharing again. And say thank you to all who came out and joined us this evening. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol, just up Colonial on 22nd Street. And can someone please read the last two paragraphs on page 164?
Hey, everybody, Kevin, from the Hibbert Front.
Kevin.
We'll close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and glory.